Professor Roger Trigg. It was interesting that last week there was a meeting of the Church of Ireland bishops who met with their Church of England, Scotland and Welsh counterparts, and we met in Oxford. We meet every 2 years, all of us together, and we met in Oxford in St. Hugh's College, and I walked down the Banbury Road in Oxford, and I walked past Kellogg College, which I'd never noticed before. But Kellogg College is where the professor spends at least part of his time. His pedigree or qualifications for dealing with the subject today are undisputable. He is academic director of the Centre for Study of Religion in Public Life in the Kellogg College in Oxford. He's a senior research fellow in the university there and the Faculty of Theology, and he's a member of the Faculty of Philosophy. He's emeritus professor of philosophy in the University of Warwick. Do you want me to go on? The list is endless. He has written at least 12 books and is writing, I think, another 12 right at this moment. One of the latest ones is entitled Religion in Public Life, Must Faith Be Privatized? ? He's also written one entitled Morality Matters. Religion in a pluralist society is a major theme that he follows, as is science and religion and the relationship between the two. And relativism is something that he lies awake at night and thinks about. He is an Anglican, a member of the Church of England, and I ask you to give a round of applause and a welcome to Professor Roger Trigg.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to just carry on, really, from the last session. You've seen the problem, and I want to talk about some of the principles that perhaps lie behind this. But first, can I just quote from something I was reading in the Irish Times this morning? I thought I'd better get up on a bit of local colour and was looking at the paper, and I saw this report about the European Court of Human Rights, a decision that it made yesterday. Human rights judges have ruled that a Catholic parish in Germany violated the rights of a church organist when it dismissed him for adultery and bigamy. And the Strasbourg court ruling is that he received inadequate treatment from the German courts. The interests of the church employer had not been balanced against Mr. Schuth's right to respect for his private and family life, but only against his interest in keeping his post. Now, I don't know the full details. I'll be interested to read all of that in the original judgment. But the tenor of it is clear enough that, in fact, what you've got is a church trying to enforce its own moral discipline on its own employees, and it's told that it cannot, that it can have an organist. I'm not quite sure of the force of the word bigamy there, whether he actually committed a crime or whether that's just bigamy in the eyes of the Catholic Church. But certainly he was behaving in a way that everybody accepted was against Catholic doctrine, and that shouldn't matter. His private human rights, his rights as a person, overrode any kind of rights the Church might have as an institution, and his rights to family life overrode any rights to the freedom of the church or religious freedom. And this is a pattern that you find coming up again and again. Now, we were looking at United Kingdom and particularly English law in the last session. I'm not one of those who think that everything wrong in England is the fault of Brussels and the European Union, but a lot of this is coming from Europe. And I say that because it's coming to you too. You're under the same directives from Brussels. You're under the Council of Europe and the European Court of Human Rights. The judgments made in Strasbourg affect you, which of course is why that's being reported in the Irish Times. It may not be as directly in Irish law as it is in English law, but Strasbourg, in the end, is setting the standard. And you can see this very much when you read things that, for instance, the Council of Europe says. In a paper that they wrote on secularity and religion a couple of years ago, they made it quite clear that human rights should always override religion. And I think that this is something that one can't, in fact, emphasize too much, that here what they're doing is saying that religion is something that must take second place. That, in fact, what happens here is that the assembly, and I'm just going to quote so that you can see I'm not making it up, it says that states should not allow the dissemination of religious principles which, if put into practice, would violate human rights. And there you can see there's a complete, explicit view that religion and human rights are at odds with each other. There are two things about that I want to come back to. But let me just quote the next thing the Assembly says. States must require religious leaders to take an unambiguous stand in favour of the precedence of human rights as set forth in the European Convention on Human Rights over any religious principle. States must require, you can imagine, states requiring the Pope perhaps to undergo rigorous training in human rights, Anglican Catholic bishops to go on courses. I'm not joking because that's what they're saying here. When I pointed this out to a member of the Council of Europe, as you know, members of Parliament go from Parliaments to represent their countries in the Council of Europe, a member of the British Parliament said to me, oh, you don't have to take any notice of that. People don't bother about what they say. But they do say it, and I suspect it does influence the European Court, which does influence law. It's all part of what's going on in Europe. That particular report was written by a Spanish socialist. That rather perhaps buys into particular arguments in Spain. But it's very much in tune with the views of secularists in France, too. And it reminds me that there are two ways of looking at the whole position of religion and human rights. One is this one, that religion and human rights are absolutely opposed to each other. That, in fact, human rights were the sign of reason breaking into the world in the Enlightenment in the 18th century. The glorious reason and freedom brought by the French Revolution with all its bloodshed will, in fact, triumph over the authoritarian obscurantism of particularly the Roman Catholic Church. You can see there's great anti-clericalism in all of this. And that's the later Enlightenment, materialist, anti-clerical, yes, emphasizing freedom, but forgetting the roots of that freedom. Because I often reflect that if you look at the slogan of the French Revolution, égalité, fraternité, liberté, freedom, equality, brotherhood, where do those concepts come from? They were proclaimed, for instance, let's take brotherhood. That's an old-fashioned concept because it seems a bit sexist, but the idea is we're all children of God. There can't be any other idea. It doesn't make any sense to say we're all brothers if there isn't a father. Where's freedom? Where does that come from? A very obvious answer is we're all free because God has given us free will. That's the theological answer. And I think it's an answer that's enormously important. Equality. And that's, of course, a buzzword nowadays. I'm writing a book at the moment about the way in which equality and freedom are fighting against each other in the field of religion. And equality is always trumping religion at the moment, as we saw in the courts in the last session. But why are people equal? Why should they be equal? If you look around the world, a lot of countries don't believe people are equal. They don't treat them as equal. It's all very well saying people are equal because that's what we say they are. Or that people are equal because that's what human rights documents say. Why should we follow what human rights documents say? Why should President Mugabe in Zimbabwe bother about human rights documents? He quite clearly doesn't. Why should the Chinese? They say it's just a Western construction. It's Western imperialism on the march, trying to impose our views on them. And therefore, why are these things important? What are human rights based on? I think this is actually not a rhetorical question. It's something that everybody ought to reflect. And if they want to make religion opposed to human rights, they have to think what foundation is left for human rights if people are no longer equal because we're equal in the sight of God. That's surely the traditional reason. That's why in Europe in the 18th century those views were able to gain currency, because they were grown in Christian soil. Take away the Christian roots, can they survive? Those are so-called modernist views. I'm not going to get too involved in heavy philosophy, but even the term postmodernist does occur in the popular press and on radio nowadays, particularly coupled with the word relativism. Postmodernism is the reaction against modernism, against the view that there is such a thing as reason and there is such a thing as truth. But the trouble about modernism is that it thought of reason and truth completely as free-floating, as not based on anything, because it had done away with God. And I think that postmodernism raises the question, how can you validate reason and truth if you've left God and the whole notion of objective value out of things completely? It's so easy then to end up with what the Pope so rightly calls the dictatorship of relativism. So, what are human rights based on? So far from being antagonistic to religion, I would say they need religion. But there is another point. What the Council of Europe says, suggests, and directorate directives from Brussels tend to assume very often, that religion, as we saw in the last session, is a danger. It's a threat. It's something that produces violence. It produces discord. It's something to be controlled. And therefore, human rights must be safeguarded against this terrible external threat. And yet, if you look carefully at all human rights constitutions and conventions, you will see that one of the most important of all human rights is the right to religious freedom, very often coupled with freedom of conscience. Now, if you believe in human rights, you have to believe in religious freedom. You can't pick and choose and say, well, I believe in that right, but not this one. And actually, I would argue that religious freedom is the most basic of all human rights, except perhaps the right to life, because if you haven't got any life, you're not going to be able to be free to be religious. But given that as a start, once we make any rational decision, it surely has to be based on what we most think important and worthwhile, and that's inevitably going to involve our judgments about religion. Not necessarily for religion, because when I'm talking about freedom of religion, I'm talking about the freedom to reject religion as well. That's important. But the freedom to think about religion and make up one's own mind about it. So that's of immense importance. The United States Constitution, in its First Amendment, goes straight into freedom of religion, freedom of practice of religion. Free exercise is the word that's used. And that brings me back to the question of the Enlightenment. I talked about the later Enlightenment in France and its materialism. But there was an earlier part of the Enlightenment that I think started in England. I'm not just being parochial or patriotic in saying this. I mean, if you look at the history, if you look at, say, now, what's the most one of the most important things about the modern world? It's science. Where did science start? I think you could say 17th century Cambridge with people like Newton. What were the ideas inspiring them? What was the philosophy of the period? And if you look at it, it was being inspired particularly by theologians, well, particularly called Cambridge Platonists, whose watchword was, and it's a motto that you can see in, for instance, the stained glass in Emmanuel College, Cambridge, reason is the candle of the Lord. And I think that's rather a lovely phrase, because it suggests that reason isn't a powerful searchlight, it's a bit weak, but it also suggests it's based on God. And the early Enlightenment saw reason as guaranteed by God. So reason, although it needed freedom, and the Cambridge Platonists believe very firmly in free will, although it needed freedom, it had at its grounding a religious standpoint. Now that was important because Newton believed in God, that's why he believed the world was ordered. It was important too because it influenced John Locke, 17th century British philosopher, Now, he's important. I mean, he was actually very much involved with the Cambridge Platonists, not just because he went to hear them preach as he did, but because he nearly married the daughter of one of them. So he actually was very closely involved. But John Locke was, I suppose it's reasonable to say, the patron saint of the foundation of the United States. He, of course, was the philosopher very much behind the 1688 Glorious Revolution in Britain when William and Mary came over. He was even on the boat coming over with Queen Mary. He believed in freedom. He believed in religious freedom. And his were the views partly that inspired the Great Act of Toleration of 1689, which was the beginning of the steps towards ever-increasing religious freedom in England. And this itself inspired a century later people like Jefferson in the United States to campaign for real religious freedom first in Virginia and then in the United States as a whole. But the point about John Locke is that he believed in equality, he believed in freedom, but these were against the background of a theology, of a belief in God. He believed that people were equal because he believed in God who'd given them the equality. He believed in natural rights because they were grounded in God. So though he was a great science-based philosopher, he was also a very religious philosopher who wrote a book, for instance, on the reasonableness of Christianity. He believed that reason and Christianity had to be closely linked. So you have here then an issue of human rights needing religion and religious freedom being built in to the very basis of the whole issue of religion. So that would suggest that religion ought to be center stage in any championing of freedom. At the very end of the previous talk, there was the question, why is religious freedom important? And the answer was that because freedom is. Of course, I think that too. But I think that there is something special about religious freedom, and I don't think we should be afraid to champion this. As I've said, by religious freedom, I include the right to deny religion, so I'm not just pushing religion. But a freedom in a particular area of human life is worthy of special protection. You'll find that totalitarian states invariably gun for religion straight away. They want, if they can't actually control it, they want to somehow push it away on one side. I've been reading a book recently, a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And there, I mean, he was, of course, one of the main opponents of Hitler and involved indeed in a plot to assassinate Hitler. But he was very wary of the Nazi attempt to try and win over Christians, manipulate the church, and use the church to be subservient to Nazi ideology. Of course, it's a very easy thing to do, to get caught up in that in a totalitarian state, because it happens very gradually. But before long, you find the church has literally lost its soul and is being controlled by a totally alien power. It's very important, therefore, for the church and for Christians to set up a standard against or apart from the state. And one of the troubles nowadays, and you see it from what's happening in court cases in Britain, is that the secular authorities are behaving as if they are the ultimate authority. Now, just think about that. They're being no different from Hitler. They're being no different from communist authorities when they say that. They're saying the state will decide. The state will decide what freedom you have. It isn't that you have freedoms because God has given them to you. You're not just important because God thinks you're important. You're not loved because God loves you. You have these statuses because the state, out of its gracious attitude, will in fact allow you to have that recognition. Now, that is something I think no Christian can accept. There was a question about natural law, and I think that the notion of natural law as being over and against the ordinary law of the state, and in fact, in some sense, in judgment on it, is terribly important. So you've got then a situation here where step by step the state is enforcing views on individuals and on institutions. Now, of course, one of the things about this thing I read from the Irish Times this morning about the Rome, the Catholic Church that was told who it could employ, is that that's actually striking at the roots of an ability of an institution to stand by its own teaching. And I find that one of the things that's happening in, is that there is a tendency for religious freedom to be respected, but for it to be so circumscribed that it means very little. We had the clauses in the European Convention on Human Rights up on the screen. You remember there that the first clause was that you've in a sense got an absolute right of freedom of religion and belief, and then immediately there are qualifications being built in. And limitations. Now, the absolute right is a right to believe what you want. But you soon found, yes, you are free to believe what you want as long as you don't show it. Now, I think most totalitarian states would settle for that. As long as people conform, if they really think something different inside, does it matter? I mean, a really efficient totalitarian state gets everyone believing what they're doing. And perhaps there's a certain instability in being afraid that perhaps people aren't really with you. But nevertheless, if you can get them to behave through the threat of tanks or whatever, that's probably good enough. So the idea that you've got religious freedom if you've got freedom of belief, but you can't manifest it, is a very, very dangerous one. The idea which is also coming up in the British courts that you've got freedom of religion and belief if you've got freedom of worship and that's all that matters, and again we saw that in our session, that's equally dangerous because that's again circumscribing religious belief. It's saying that freedom of worship is all right, you can go to Mass, church on Sunday, you dare show your belief in your life and you're for it. And this is where we're getting. In European law, you have complete freedom of religion in employment if you're free to give up your job. Now, what that means is if you're required to do something against your conscience, if you can walk out of your job, you're free. You shouldn't have the job. Now, this has actually been said explicitly in cases, for instance, on Sunday working. I suppose it applies to the civil registrar case as well. She's got complete religious freedom because she shouldn't be a registrar. It doesn't matter that the conditions of the job have changed even while she was doing it, but she shouldn't, in fact, be doing the job. Now, I think the freedom to be unemployed is not much of a religious freedom. And so, again, you can see how everything is being circumscribed. There's been here no attempt at accommodation at all. I warmed to what was being said in the last session about the need for reasonable accommodation. As we could see, there's little attempt in the Liddell case, the civil registrar case, to accommodate her. There's no attempt in the Catholic Adoption Agency cases to accommodate. And I think that if you really believe that religious freedom is a right, then it must balance other rights. It is not always trumped by other rights. And then you're into issues about proportionality, whether in fact there's a tremendous burden on religious believers, whether in fact things can be accommodated in such a way. Quite clearly, gay couples could adopt if Catholic adoption agencies remained in existence and only gave to Catholic couples, for instance, or if they wanted to be as restrictive as that. Why shouldn't they provide a limited service to a limited group of people? There seem to be no reason why other people's rights are not being affected. So, again, there's no idea of reasonable accommodation, of proportionality there at all. And I think that any kind of approach to rights, however much you accept, for instance, the rights of the gay community, they should also accept the rights of religious believers. Religious freedom is as much a right as the right not to be discriminated against. In fact, I was rather amused at the Lillian Adele case, because as you could see from her photograph, this never actually surfaced, but she was black. I wonder if she'd said, "You're doing this because I'm black," she probably would have got quite away. Now, I mean, that wasn't the issue, and she was honest, it was because of her religion. But religious discrimination ought to be as serious as racial discrimination. And yet, somehow or other, it's being marginalised the whole time. I was interested to see here in Ireland that your debate about civil partnerships has exposed an unwillingness on the part of the government to allow any legal exceptions. And it's this business about accommodation and exceptions that I think becomes particularly important. The notion that the balance is important. The Minister for Justice, Dermot O'Hearn, said in the Dáil, "What would the consequences be if we were to allow officials to choose the parts of their job they wouldn't do on the basis of their religious beliefs?" And those with conscientious objections to civil partnerships were dismissed by the Minister for the Environment, John Gormley, as having old and discredited prejudices. Well, that's not much respect for religious freedom, is it? But similar attitudes are gaining ground in Britain, so I mean... And as I said, it's all coming from Europe too. There's a conformity to a certain kind of view, which is very often anti-religious. Now let me just produce a different example, and it's one that through the centuries has caused problems. In 18th century Philadelphia, when the Pennsylvania colony was caught up in the war for independence against Britain, of course, Pennsylvania was largely a Quaker foundation. There were a lot of Quakers there. Quakers there objected to fighting. They didn't want to be called up. Not surprisingly, a lot of people thought that therefore that meant they were loyalists, and there were a lot of loyalists around in the in what was to be the United States, that they were supporting Britain. But that wasn't the case. They just weren't willing to fight and to kill. And so there was a great debate about this. And in the end, they were allowed not to fight, but they were required to contribute money. So that was a kind of reasonable accommodation. So they didn't get out of it. They didn't get out of their duties as citizens. But at least they weren't required to act against their conscience, to be complicit in what they regarded as a great moral evil. And as the years have gone on, we've accepted that conscientious objection in time of war is a legitimate thing. If people sincerely believe that what they're doing is wrong, if they're sincere pacifists, for instance, they should not be required to go and fight. And it's been thought, it was in the Second World War in Britain, it's been thought to be part of a civilized society, to respect that kind of conscience. Again, there was an issue of accommodation, and obviously a lot of people didn't like the fact that some people looked as if they were getting out of risking their lives. But the respect for conscience was important. And you could see why people believe that. I think it's important you shouldn't kill. I think you should only be driven to it in very extreme circumstances. So you could see where they're coming from. And I think in these cases, I mean, very often in the Dáil, for instance, people were saying, you know, once you allow exceptions, people can refuse to do anything for any reason. Well, that's obviously not true, because there are some clear moral imperatives based in religion that we can all recognise. We can all see, for instance, the burning issue at the moment is homosexuality, but you can see why people object to homosexual marriage, for instance. It's against a very long line of religious teaching. So it isn't an arbitrary judgment by one individual saying, I don't feel like doing that. It's coming from a position that deserves respect, even if people don't agree with it. And why does it deserve respect? Why shouldn't conformity be established? Well, we get back to, I suppose, the whole issue of what is democracy about. There is no need for democracy if we all agree. Democracy, after all, is a form of government for us if we disagree. It's to decide who gets their way. And to do that, everybody has to contribute to the public debate, saying what they think is worthwhile, what they think is good. And if some voices are shut out of it at the very beginning, democracy is not functioning. So it's important that individuals take their full part in their discussion. I think it's also important that institutions play their role. There's a tendency nowadays for institutions to be squeezed out, and I include churches in this. But if there's no gap between, in a sense, the state and the individual, inevitably, in respecting the autonomy of the individual, there will be limits placed on that because we can't all be autonomous, we'll all be fighting each other. So the state is going to get more powerful. So institutions provide an important buffer between individual and the state. Institutions, in fact, are part of what enables us to be a free and pluralist society. So democracy itself is in danger if individuals can't say what they think and institutions can't function. So religious freedom particularly is important in that area. I haven't got time now to say why I think religion is of particular importance, except let me just say it is deeply rooted in human nature. There is a lot of evidence, which I could detail because I've been involved in a research project in Oxford for the last 3 years on this, a lot of evidence from the cognitive science of religion showing it's part of how we're made that people react in a religious way to things, that they can conceive of an omniscient God, perhaps, or they can conceive of mind outside body, of life after death. There are all kinds of empirical evidence that show that religion isn't just something that's happened or cropped up, it's universal, which is why that when it's suppressed, it will always reoccur. It's part of what it is to be human. And again, if a democracy does not take that central core of humanity seriously, it is not taking what it is to be human seriously. Thank you.
Warm applause, Professor. Thank you very much. And you have kept well within your time, generously, to allow more time for questions, and we appreciate that. And I'm sure there will be responses, comments, and questions from the floor. We have a microphone here that's ready to... Where's my microphone holder? Has she left? Can you carry the microphone to the man in the red sweater in the second row, please? Yes, sir.
I think it might be helpful for people assembled here to be afforded a reliable and clear definition of secular humanism and perhaps its opposite. Thank you.
I think secular human... I mean, secular humanism is an interesting phrase because I wonder how humanism can actually survive in a secular society. And, I mean, this comes back to issues about postmodernism. There is a very real issue that if you don't think of anything universal or of any objective truth or anything beyond all society, how can you talk about what it is to be human, which is pre-social? This is quite a big issue. Some of you may remember the French philosopher Derrida, who is something of a guru. I remember once he came to the University of Warwick and gave a lecture, and I asked him after in the lecture how it was he could talk about human nature as a postmodernist if he didn't, in fact, think there was such a thing as being human. And I was genuinely interested to know what his answer would be, and his answer was, well, he didn't have time to answer that question. And I wasn't surprised. I'm afraid the notion of secular humanism, just as the notion of humanism, seems to me to be a fundamentally unstable concept. The two parts are fighting against each other. Being human, I mean, I always think that, I mean, when we meet humanists, that they're in a sense people who, from a religious background, who've given up their religion but keep the morality. And I think sometimes psychologically that's right. I wonder, from a social point of view, how long we can survive believing in humanism without the religion that gave it birth. And this goes back to a more fundamental issue, which applies to both Britain and Ireland. If, in fact, you want to get rid or ignore our religious heritage, will things just go on being the same? You just think, if you really deliberately want to remove our religious heritage, as some people do, just what will happen to everything? I mean, from a British point of view, we change our national flag for a start. Crosses of Patrick, George, Andrew, out because they're Christian. And this isn't a silly issue because there's a case in front of the European Court at the moment about whether schools in Italy can display a crucifix. And I was at a conference where people were talking about that, and a Scandinavian said quite seriously, if that case goes against the crucifix, where does that leave the flags of Scandinavian countries, all of which have crosses? I mean, and there was also, more fundamentally, a case coming from the European Court about Norway, which criticised the teaching of Christianity in Norwegian schools. It was daring to suggest that perhaps there's a qualitative difference between Christianity and other religions. In other words, it wasn't being taught from a relativist point of view, no such thing as truth. I don't think there intentionally was, but in implication, the court was worried that actually there was a suggestion that, heaven forbid, Christianity might even be true, or the kind of thing that could be true. And the European Court's dead against that, you see. It's putting forward a pluralist society, and I think all too often pluralist means relativist.
Thank you. Oh, yes?
Just to clarify, Professor, is really the word secular, people perhaps flounder without a clear and reliable definition of where does the word secular come from, what's it based on, what's its reference for?
Did people hear the question?
Well, of course,
the word secular.
I mean, there is a religious background for the use of the term secular, but I think as it's being used nowadays, I'm afraid it just means anti-religious, doesn't it? I mean, it's being defined in contrast to religion, and I'm sure that's what that's really... I mean, it just means if it's religious, you can't have it. Yes, there's... for instance, in civil wedding ceremonies in England now, you're not allowed to have anything religious, so you couldn't have any kind of poem that mentioned God or anything like that. And in a sense, the whole thing is being defined as being not religious. We don't do that kind of thing.
Now, there's a question over here in the shadows around the corner, sir.
Thanks. You mentioned Minister Ahern briefly.
Yeah.
He made a very profound statement recently, most people in the audience would be familiar with it, that he would not let religion cloud his conscience when it comes to making decisions in the public arena. And I was just thinking, why are our public representatives so afraid to have a principled conscience? And if they do have a principled conscience, which helps them make the right decisions, where do those principles come from if they're not of a moral and a religious background?
Well, quite. I mean, I think that religion, if one has what has it, is going to tell one what is most worthwhile, what is most important, what is true about the world, and that will inform one's conscience. So an informed conscience is bound to be influenced by one's, in a sense, basic metaphysical worldview. So to say that religion will cloud the conscience, again, it's all this idea that religion is opposed to human rights and so on. It's an anti-religious view. It's religion as danger, not religion as guaranteeing our freedoms and everything that's important.
Question on the front row. A lady in the front row first, yes, and then the gentleman over to the left.
Yeah, thank you for that fascinating talk. Can I ask you a question about the United States in comparison to Europe? Has the United States been through these kinds of debates at a philosophical level in the way that Europe is experiencing them now? Or have they ever had occasion to have them because of the way the Constitution is framed and the separation of church and state and the mutual respect?
I think that's an interesting question, and if you're not careful, I could go on for an hour about that, because it's actually a very topical question. Basically, I think the United States, although it believes in the separation of church and state, has had what you might call a civic religion. It believes in God, but not a denominational God. So it's not a Catholic God or a Protestant God, not even perhaps a Christian God, because it wants to bring Jews in. But God is there. One nation under God, the Pledge of Allegiance says. And this has underpinned the whole of their public life, that religion is there, informing it, informing conscience. But now, very recently, in recent years, we're getting precisely the debates in the United States that we're getting in Europe. I'm going to be involved in a project with Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., on religious freedom, and in a sense I'm going to be dealing with Europe and they're dealing with the United States, because the same issues occur, absolutely. Let me just give one concrete example of a case I came across. William and Mary College in Williamsburg in Virginia, very old, established, chapel designed allegedly by Christopher Wren, I mean certainly from the 17th century, one of the very oldest buildings, the oldest universities in the United States, founded as the chapel founded as part of the Church of England in Virginia, then Episcopal through the 19th century. Now, the president of the college said 2 or 3 years ago, we can't have the cross in that chapel. That's, in a sense, divisive. It's exclusive. It suggests the chapel's for Christians. We can't have that. I mean, I suppose, logically, one should say the chapel shouldn't be for people who believe in anything. It's just a public space. And so he said, we're going to remove the cross. I'm not going to have any suggestion that a public university is supporting Christianity. And, of course, all hell was let loose, and actually, in the end, he had to resign. But the cross isn't there on the altar now. It's in a glass of Perspex case as a museum piece alongside. It can be taken out for services, I suppose, but it's there as a relic of the history, not as a functioning part of the chapel. And you can see that this kind of aggressive secularism is now there in the United States, and just... I mean, it's coming up in the Supreme Court time and time again, too. So, in a sense, the kind of thing you get in the European Court of Human Rights is coming up in the Supreme Court in the United States. If I could just make one point about that. In the earlier session, it was pointed out that one vote in the British Supreme Court went 5-4 of the 9 judges. Most of these cases tend to be like that in the European Court or the United States Supreme Court or the Canadian Supreme Court, all of which get these cases. It's always about one judge in it. And yet the whole ethos of a country can be changed by the judgment of one judge. I mean, that Norwegian case, which is affecting Norway very much in the European Court, with one judge, if they'd swapped, it would have gone the other way. And there seems to me something to be very wrong about that, and it does raise the issue whether all these things are matters for courts rather than parliaments, actually. But that's a big issue.
Can we stay on the front row? Yes, sir.
Yeah, thanks for... my name's Tony Allwright. Thanks for a very fascinating talk. You start out in the beginning. In fact, you alluded to it quite a bit about the tension between EU doctrines and religion.
Yeah.
And basically that EU human rights always trump religious
rights.
That's actually not true, unless you define more closely what religions you're talking about, because they most certainly do not trump Islamic rights. Islamic rights, I'm talking about the right to beat your wife, the right to female genital mutilation, the right to honor killings, the right to the whole business of cartoons and so forth. In all those areas, all what we used to call Christian societies, now I suppose Western, secular, whatever, are more and more deferring to Islam. So the anti-religious sense that you have across Europe is actually anti-Christian, anti-Jewish. It is not anti-religion per se, and it's certainly not anti-Islam.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point, because you get the issue of minorities. I think very often it's viewed then not so much as religious freedom as the rights of minorities and the rights of minority cultures, and then that other elements come in. I was talking to somebody from the Equality and Human Rights Commission in London, and they said, but of course we're more interested in the disadvantaged. We want to help the disadvantaged. And the idea is minorities are disadvantaged, so we bother about Muslims, particularly Muslim women. Christians are by definition in the majority, so tough. Well, that's not good enough, I don't think.
Now, I'm going to show that there are as many rights for the people sitting at the back as there are at the front. And
very good.
Microphone, please, to the very back first. Even before you. Very back, please. Sorry, we'll come back.
And the topic today is in defense of religious freedom. And I believe that here in Ireland, we have a great deal of power at our disposal. And I'd be interested to know, with the type of power which I just outlined brief, whether you would agree that we'd have the same kind of power in Great Britain. We can pick up the telephone here and ring RTE and make a complaint, which I have done on many occasions. Although on Sunday last, I complained about the poor coverage given by the national broadcaster to the papal visitor. I was assured I'd receive a call the following day, which I never received. To give you another example, recently here in Ireland, we had the People of the Year Award. And one of the awards was made to a group called GLEM, Gay Lesbian Equality Network. And I was waiting to see some response from the public that I thought this was a very lopsided, I thought there was a agenda, secularist agenda behind this awarding of an award, a national award to this group. And I just would feel that I was very annoyed by it, but I didn't see any response to it. But I feel that we as a group are very grateful to groups such as the Iona Institute that give us a platform. And just finally, I will give you...
Can you keep your comment brief, please?
Yes, just on this. I'll finish on this point. I had a letter published in the Irish Times in 2008 when I complained about the showing of the film The Song of Bernadette at 3:35 a.m. in the morning. I was glad to see that after 2 years, RTE showed it at lunchtime last Sunday. Thank you.
Do you want to comment?
No, I'd hear something else. Yes.
Can we go to the very back, which is where I really intended, but there we are.
Hello, Professor. Thank you for bringing the light a little bit closer to us. Some of you raised already about circularism. This so-called circularist society is actually an encircling society, which to encircle people of religion. Now, our spiritual directors will probably elaborate on it a bit further, but I see religion actually as an expression of our faith, and our faith is our conscience and our belief and a bit more. So raising your point earlier that by stamping down on people of religion, they're actually coming from trying to be authoritative to be authoritarian. So what they're trying to create is an authoritarian society which clamps down on people of faith. Because if you exclude people of faith, people of conscience, people of belief from society, then you gain control of it. Is that what you are trying to raise this?
Yes, I mean, all this, of course, is in the name of very often liberalism, and it does worry me that I find that liberals are remarkably intolerant of those who don't agree with them. And and therefore, although they seem to be standing by freedom, they're not. Don't forget that the test of liberalism, the test of respecting freedom, is allowing people you violently disagree with, who think you're basically wrong, express and practice their views. We can all be liberals to those we agree with. So it's the people that you find quite abhorrent. I mean, obviously one problem in this case is that there are limits. So I'm not going to allow everything to be done in the name of religion, human sacrifice, for instance. But within limits, in a free society, we ought to be very, very reluctant to stop people expressing their religion, even if we don't like what they're doing. And liberals don't seem to understand that.
Now, we'll come to the last question, I'm afraid, and we have to come back to this man who I was unfair to a moment ago.
I'm glad to see our chairman pushing the equality agenda. I'd like to ask what the professor thinks has been the cause of this radical change in attitudes in the last 20 years. I mean, we look at public attitude surveys here now, and they're the complete reverse of what would have been the case 20 years ago, and presumably the same throughout Europe. What do you think is the underlying cause for this change in attitude throughout the public?
Well, I think it's unfortunately fairly simple that if you go... I don't know quite what the position would be here, but if you go to many churches in England and look around, even now when I look around, I think, gosh, I'm the youngest here. They've got aging congregations and young people aren't there. And as you go through the generations, the people who are in power are people who've not been brought up to be religious, whose parents probably weren't religious, who understand nothing about Christianity. Unfortunately, I think very often they're not opposed to it, they just don't understand it, they're indifferent to it. And I think that this secularism is the product of the loss of grip on human imagination, human understanding by the Christian churches. That's particularly true in England, where I think there's been a tremendous falling off of influence on many people under, say, the age of 40. And I think it's very worrying. So that I'm afraid that what one has to do is to win back hearts and minds, not just for principles about religious freedom, but back to Christianity and its importance. And it is important, and sometimes even people like Richard Dawkins see where they're getting, because he suddenly sees the vacuum created by Christianity. If there isn't it, I mean, what is going to withstand? What's going to stand against radical Islam, for instance, if the country isn't Christian? He himself betrays very much, I think, some of the remnants of an upbringing in Christianity. I mean, you can see with the things, his attitudes to some things. And if people haven't been brought up like that, if they're totally ignorant about anything to do with Christianity, then you've lost something that is really tremendously important.
Now, if you haven't asked a question yet, all is not lost, because at the end there will be an opportunity to ask a question of any of our panelists after our final speaker. Could we show our appreciation, please, to Professor Craig?